right club. Be the right club today.
Yeah. Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most.
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We have a great interview with Paul Azinger coming your way here shortly. I was down in the area and wanted to hit him up. We're working on some Ryder Cup stuff, so we hit him up to do some video and said, hey, while we're down here, we'd like to catch up with you on the pod. It's been a couple years since you were on, and he's been covering live golf for NBC in that time period. Wanted to get his feedback on how that was going and a bunch of other issues in the game of golf. I promise we are going to eventually get younger with the guests that we're going to be having with the upcoming Florida swing. It was not scheduled for us to have this many guys in their 60s and even 70s consecutively, but it's just how it's worked out and how it usually works out while the big boys are out on the West Coast. So the previous episode, we covered the USGA distance report. We talked a lot about golf equipment, technology. And as it relates to that, I've been made aware there are clubs that fit in your bag in between fairway woods and your irons. They're apparently called hybrids. I have to read off of this sheet that they put in front of me. I am obligated to say that Solly thinks he's a better player than he is and refuses to try the hybrids. I cannot confirm or deny that. That is literally written in the copy. But you won't be surprised to learn that our friends at Callaway Golf have a full family of new Maverick hybrids. I can't even say the word. And just like in the Maverick driver lineup, they use artificial intelligence to design unique faces for each Maverick hybrid head. They're each built with specific player types in mind. So there's a Maverick hybrid for just about everyone, the Maverick and the Maverick Pro, which is available all the way down to the 2 hybrid. Actually, that does sound quite appealing. And there's those who need a bit more help. There's the Max, which goes all the way to the 8 hybrid, the Ocho. I bet I don't know how far into Big Randy's future the 8 hybrid is, but it's not as far away as you might think. Artificial intelligence has optimized all of them, and they are built for distance. Check out Maverick Hybrids today, CallawayGolf.com. That's CallawayGolf.com. Here is Paul Azinger. What's the transition from 1 week of PGA Tour golf a year been like to now doing however many weeks you're doing now at PGA Tour? Going from Fox US Open being your one PGA Tour week, now you're NBC a lot of weeks a year. What's that like?
Just the broadcasting part of it. It's easy enough. I mean, it was just a completely different dynamic at NBC walking into that trailer and seeing the guys that, you know, I've known all those guys for a long time, Gary and Roger and Noda and guy, who am I leaving out? It doesn't matter, Bones. I've known those guys forever, but it was just a weird dynamic to walk in there. You know, I started out at ABC with Mark Loomis as my producer, and Faldo and I started out together doing 20 tournaments a year. We did that for 2 years. ABC left golf in the new big negotiation, and I kept my card that year and broadcast 20 events. It was pretty amazing, honestly.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
20 events with your card.
And kept my card. And then Faldo ended up getting a job at CBS, and I kept playing and kept my contract with ABC turned into ESPN. And we did 5 a year, a couple of days of the Masters, U.S. Open the first 2 days, kept the British. Then eventually it just became the Open Championship, and that was only 1 a year with ESPN. And when they lost that, my contract ended. And then Loomis called me, now working at Fox, to mm-hmm. ask me about that. And it just worked out. The timing was perfect. They moved Greg out of there and brought me in. And I got to do the U.S. Open and a few other events. So 3 or 4 a year, you're right. So I was really had a lot of anxiety about the upcoming schedule with NBC. A lot of angst about it because, you know, I didn't got to go to Phoenix and let Johnny retire on Saturday, and then I have to start on Sunday. That there was a lot of anxiety for that, I have to tell you.
That's a no-win situation, taking over for Johnny Miller.
That is, you know, it's probably a no-win, but I didn't look at it like that as much as just the anxiety of waiting for it. I felt like I could be myself. I'm still trying to be myself in that broadcast booth with NBC.
Is it hard to do?
Yeah, it's fast-paced.
Why is that?
It just is fast paced. But anyway, just real quick, yeah. I started out Sunday at Phoenix to do the final round, which was, you know, I'm glad to get that. I got that behind me. Then waited to go to Mexico City. I didn't know what Mexico City was like. I haven't been down there in a while. So there was some of that anticipation, anxiety. Then got through that. Next thing is the Florida swing up to the Players. Got through that. Then 6 weeks off, U.S. Open. Women's and men's, got through that. Then six more weeks off, the British Open with NBC. Got back to seeing those guys again. You know, it's different. But everything I felt like I got through last year. And now my rookie year's over. I think I'll be a little bit more myself, maybe be able to contribute a little bit more idea-wise. I just kind of wanted to sit back my first year at NBC and see how they do things. They're the experts. Tommy Roy's won 32 Emmys. Tommy Randolph's been there forever. Doug Graybert is setting cameras, and he's brilliant. You know, they've got it put together there. Dan Hicks is off the charts, so I didn't want to get in their way. And but now I feel like I see some things that I had to adjust to that, you know, just like time to get in and say what I'm supposed to say. But it's a fast-paced show. Tommy gets a lot of people in. It's quick in, quick out. He doesn't lollygag around. And he's a quick decision maker, and I love working for him.
And that's what I think I'm starting to gain more and more appreciation for when announcers are up. And that's what I want to compare how that works between Fox and NBC. It seems like with NBC and PGA Tour Golf, with how tight the coverage windows are in between commercial breaks, there's a lot more commercial breaks, it seems like. It seems like it's just fast. It's like, hey, you're up, go. You got 8 seconds to do this, and then you're out. Yep. And you don't have that opportunity to really flesh out a thought in nearly as much as when things are stuck in a longer shot with Fox or the U.S. Open. Is that am I onto something there, at least a little bit?
You're absolutely onto something. Gil Capps, who sits between Dan Hicks and I, and you know, has a bunch of data for us if we need it, and he holds the scoreboard for Hicks. I talked to him about it, and he thinks, you know, he said to me, you know, sometimes when you don't have a lot of time, you don't get yourself in trouble. And I was like, ah, I didn't think about it like that, but that's brilliant. But the philosophy is to get as many shots in as you can.
Sure.
And you know what? It's easier. And bottom line is Sunday's all that matters. I mean, everything matters. Tommy Roy wants the best Thursday show of any Thursday show ever, every Thursday. That's how he lives his life. So does Tommy Randolph. And we all want to be great every day. But Sunday's the day when you have to peak and really have your thoughts together and you know what's happened in the meantime. But the great thing with NBC that I'm not used to is that when we come on air Saturday, Sunday, they're already on the fifth hole, so the story's writing itself. At Fox in the U.S. Open, we'll be on air 2 hours before the leaders come off, and I feel more of a burden or a responsibility to almost, not an essay, but to just analyze how they're thinking when their brain shuts off, if it can, and when it clicks back. All that stuff that, you know, my goal is to let the picture be descriptive, and I try to be informative. That's the bottom line, because we can watch it with the mute button on. But it is a different style. Got to be informative, much faster at NBC.
That's what I'm getting at is I love the opportunity to talk to broadcasters and let them, you get to air out all your thoughts here. You're not up against any bumper of any kind. And that's where I think you guys can come under fire from a lot of people, and that it's your job's hard. Like, it's hard to be like, hey, on, go, be insightful, and get out on time. Like, that's a hard thing to do, three things at once pretty much there.
Well, you can hear yourself. You can hear the producer right in your ear and talking where
while
we're going next.
Yeah.
Could be talking while, I'm sure he tries not to,
yeah,
but he could be. And that's part of it, but you get used to it, I think. I don't hear it as much. So you think differently. You think in blurts. I think in blurts. Mm-hmm. Quick little blurbs, maybe. Blurb's the word. What's mm-hmm. blurt?
I don't...
Quick blurbs. In and out.
You're not really on Twitter anymore. What's the feedback been like for you since you've been to NBC? What's the medium for which you receive feedback from?
Media-wise, I haven't had, like, great stories of success or great stories of failure, you know. Like I say, my rookie year's over, and everything from now on is going to be familiar. They're going to be familiar with me. I'm familiar with them. They know me now. Hicks knows me. I know Dan, and I just feel like that I'm going to be a lot more relaxed and maybe a little bit different. This next season, but I forget even what you asked me now.
No, that's just, I mean, basically what I'm
when people criticize, like on Twitter, I mean, that's what you want Twitter for, is to roast people anonymously. Yeah. I mean, that's the fun of Twitter. Sure. That's what it's all about. So I take it with a grain of salt. If I get killed on Twitter in the mentions or whatever, all I have to do is look to see who else is getting slaughtered that is great broadcast. Every one of them gets slaughtered.
Yeah, it's,
so
not,
it's not a barometer anymore.
You're not going to, it's not, you're not set up with an opportunity for, I'm saying your job is not, it's really hard to have an amazing day. You know what I mean? It's hard to do a
But how do you even quantify an amazing day? Dude, you remember when I said this? How about when I said that? You know, now I want credit for saying that I, at the end of the President's Cup, I said, you know, if you're a fantasy golf guy, you might want to load up on some of these players, because the international team all left with confidence, and so did the American team, because mm-hmm. they went and they're all in mid-season form at the start of the season. And sure enough, here they go. You had three guys from President's Cup in the Tournament of Champions, Justin Thomas, Xander Schauffele, and so, yeah, all these guys.
Patrick Reed was in the playoff there.
All President's Cup players. So, yeah. But it's like, I want to say,
I told you.
Does anyone remember when I said that? It's stupid, because you just say it. It just comes out. It's remembered when it's wrong, and it's usually not remembered when it's wrong.
That sounds pretty accurate. Faxon told a great story on here about the first NBC broadcast he ever did, and something that Tommy Roy wrote on a piece of paper for him. All it said was, "No shit." Does that sound familiar at all? What's that mean? Do you know what that means?
That means get in, get out. Don't have time to blather on. We don't want to know what you did last night. We don't want to know who you talked to. Talk about the shot. Get in, get out. You know, that job that Faxon has, and that Gary Koch has, and Faraday McCord was doing it. Now Aaron Oberholzer's doing it at CBS. Those are hard jobs, being a hole announcer. Blackmar was in Morocco and was sitting in the analyst chair. He just said, "Oh, my God. So nice,
yeah.
Not have to know everything about every player that's coming on your hole. It's a different deal."
But that was just basically, don't say anything that the viewer at home can see on the screen.
Yeah,
it's rolling. My lead in there is, what are rules of broadcasting? Are there any other rules that you try to follow? Bacon pointed out some to me, such as, you know, don't try to guess where the ball is going to go. Like, we're going to find out in 2 seconds anyway.
Those are the rules. There are several rules, I'll tell you. That's one big one. Don't guess where it's going to go. There's a sequence of order at NBC. Tommy Roy doesn't want us to speculate on, you know, if Tiger's stretching, you speculate maybe his hammy's a little tight. He doesn't even want that, which is fine. I get it. But the sequence of order is, well, you can't talk while contact's being made. Tommy Roy's big sell. Gary Koch and I talked about this the other day. I really wasn't aware of it, but his big thing, the producer, is that he wants to hear the ball get hit, because he feels like there's nothing that can bring the viewer in any closer to the telecast than the sound of contact. So that's a big thing. And our sequence of order is, the whole host, Hicks or Koch or Faraday, will go first. They bring in the guy on the ground, if there's a guy on the ground, and then the guy on the ground will set up the shot. If he doesn't stop before impact, I don't say anything. I just lay out. Once impact happens, the guy on the ground has to tell you where it's going. If I jump in there and say something before the guy tells you where it's going, I get yelled at. So there's a sequence of order. But there's some times when the guy on the ground is going to go right up to the shot, and I'm just out. There's no big deal. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm dying to say something like, but I might jump in on the shot real quick and then get out real quick and not get yelled at. And then whoever's on the ground can describe the shot. So there is a sequence of order. We have rules. You know, the first thing I ever said when Mark Loomis was asking me about the job back in 05 or 06, I said, "Can I say anything I want?" He says, "You can say anything you want once." I said, "That's fair."
That's pretty good. Well, what's something that you feel like you've learned, but the most important thing you've learned about broadcasting from the day one you started that you know now that you feel like is the most important thing you could have learned?
Oh, boy. I think as much as anything, let the picture be descriptive. And just remember, nobody's tuning in to hear you. They're tuning in to watch the golf, whether or not you're doing it. Or, you know, if John Gruden's calling Monday Night Football or if he's not, I'm still going to watch it. Doesn't matter who it is. And I think the most important thing is to be able to give an insight, you know, and not say too much. Get in, get out, be distinct, be confident, you know, not wishy-washy. I did swings a couple weeks ago in Hawaii, and some of the swings I'd see for the first time ever from behind. And then when we showed the replay, Brett, you know, the producer said, we're going to do this swing. And I'd see it for the first time in my life because, you know, we had so many players in Hawaii, you didn't know who they were. And then they'd show it from face on, a different angle. So I tried to – I remember I asked Peter Costas one time about why are your Konica Minolta swing visions so good? And he said, well, I said, if I'm calling swings, I get lost. He said, I'll focus on one thing on the backswing and one thing on the downswing, and if I want to throw anything else in there, I will. And so I would watch these guys, and I would randomly just say, in Hawaii, I would just say, watch his left knee. Now, I didn't know what his left knee was going to do, but I said it. And it was, watch his left foot, watch his right shoulder, watch his head. And everybody who was watching would watch his head, and then we were all watching together whether it moved or not. And then I would just comment, that's so still. It's just, and it within, but be emphatic. Mm-hmm. Just believe what you're saying. You want to be believable, you know, that's the key. And you want to have credibility. I played 30 years, so I have an idea what they're dealing with out there emotionally. And then, but then there's other tier players like a Rory or somebody like Tiger who's not dealing with the same thing Brendan Steele and, you know, those Cameron Smith were dealing with. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other thing for them. It's life-changing.
If you are listening to this interview with Paul Azinger, then episode 3 of Taurus Sauce is live on our YouTube channel. This season is brought to you by our friends at Original Penguin, a great apparel company that you'll see us wearing throughout the season. The Original Penguin guys were actually kind of surprised. We've been some pictures have been posted us wearing the gear outside of the Taurus Sauce season. They're kind of like, wow, not everyone that we work with does that. It's because we legitimately like it. I wore a hoodie on the golf course the other day with Neil. I don't know how many DMs I got on Instagram asking where the hoodie was from. You know where it's from. It's from Original Penguin. They've got great styles for both on the golf course and off the golf course. I think that was probably intended to be some of the off the golf course stuff, but it goes both ways. You can wear it on and off. They got styles for everyone. They got wild stuff, which you're going to see on TC and Neil this season, and they got more conservative stuff. Always remember to be an original, so go and check out our episode on YouTube and swing by originalpenguin.com. Check out the cool threads they got there. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Azinger.
Well, I think that especially where your experience pays off is coming down the stretch in the pressure situations. And I think we like kind of touched on this the last time you were on the podcast, but I didn't dive deep enough in something you mentioned called progressive relaxation. I remember that word, but I don't remember, really remember what it means, but you've always been very open about how you dealt with nerves on the golf course in pressure situations. And I think by the end of Miller's career, people made almost a meme out of, oh, that's just nerves right there.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy the way you talk about how pressure affects people. So I wonder if you can tell us about progressive relaxation, what it's like to go down the stretch of a tour event as you're trying to win it.
Nerves are the best part of the sport. It's why we watch. It's what you deal with when you play for a $5 Nassau or a club championship. You know, we're all the same. But, you know, Michael Phelps doesn't win all those gold medals if he's not nervous ahead of time. If he's just in the pool with his buddies or he's not setting any world records. It takes pressure to create those moments, you know, that are so great. But you have to learn how to cope and deal. First, you have to embrace the want to be. I want to be out there and exposed. That was what I went through. I'm sure Tiger went through it, but he went through it when he was 12 or 14. Maybe. I went through it maybe when I was 24 or 5, when I started to get in contention periodically. And you embrace that or you shy off from it. So I tried to embrace it. Bert Yancey told me once, you want to be so nervous you can't spit. And it really resonated with me, because if you're not, you're back in the middle of the pack, and that's not what you wanted. So I tried to elevate, and I got to where I embraced the pressure. Then I succeeded under pressure a few times. And then all of a sudden, it just changes. You know, and my perspective changed too. I mean, I tried to play to make history, not to make money, which was a nice luxury to have. Not everybody can have that luxury. When Brett Quigley just won, I don't think he really needs the money, but he needs status. And he was choking for status, and he got it. It's just nerves are part of it. But you get to a point, it's like giving a speech. You know, at first you can't even imagine getting in front of 600 people and speaking to them. And you're throwing up maybe. I don't know. And then you've done it enough, it's like falling off a log. That's where Tiger and Rory are. And that maybe is where Koepka has gotten to. Guys like Dustin Johnson, I don't think, are freaking out. So when you say nerves then, it's not nerves as in butterflies. It's not nerves in handshaking. It's more nerves in your brain where you let negative stuff jump in there. You know, the swing takes a second and a half. All the things that can jump in your brain in that second and a half of motion, when you're great, nothing jumps in there to slow down the fluidity of your motion. You're picturing the shot or whatever it is, and the nerves are different. But does it mean negative thoughts can't come in on Rory? Does it mean he's not battling something? It's fascinating. So the mental battle exists, even if the butterflies aren't there.
And kind of what I wanted to get at there is, and you touched on it there, but like it's impossible to tell somebody, don't be nervous. Like, hey, don't be nervous. When people get nervous, that's my instinctive advice. It's like, oh, just don't be. But I don't know how you address that. You know what I mean? And you mentioned the progressive relaxation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, all good. I just want to hear kind of, and I remember you talking about breathing, but anybody that gets nervous in their weekend game at any point, what can you teach them that's like, hey, this will potentially help you kind of deal with that?
Well, you have to talk to yourself, and you have to do certain things. Visualization is huge. When I'm in the dentist chair, I just sit there and creep my mouth open a comfortable amount and play golf courses in my head. It gets me through being at the dentist. I redirected my way right out of there. So you use those kind of, skill sets to get yourself out of tough situations mentally. But if you're at home and you have shaky hands, I really do believe that you can deep breathe your way into a better place mentally and then relax and ask, you know, why am I nervous? Prioritize what the heck you're doing. If we're on the course and you're freaking out there, there are definitely exercises that can calm you down. This generation's addressed all that. We were learning that sort of thing. Guys were showing up that were sports psychologists, sort of. The old adage when Greg Norman was on the tour, that the difference with Greg and Jack, because Jack, there were no sports psychologists in Jack's generation, and they said, oh, the difference in Greg and Jack was that the sports psychologists go to see Jack and Greg goes to see the sports psychologist. And that's kind of how that went. But with sports psychology now to where it is, these guys, they all know how to approach things mentally. And when you see, you know, a look on a guy's face and they give the cliche, you know, one shot at a time, don't get ahead of myself. When we zoom in on that shot, that's what he's trying to do right then and there. That's what's going on in his head. So there are drills and exercises and they figure out how to do it. We all do.
This could be just my childhood not remembering this right, but I feel like growing up and then maybe even a decade or even more than that ago, when I tuned into the back nine on Sunday, I felt like I had a good grasp that guys were nervous. I felt like I could see that at times, and I feel like leads were lost more frequently through poor play coming down the stretch, and I just don't get that sense nearly when I'm watching tour golf. Now, I don't watch in to be like, oh, I wonder if this guy's going to blow it here, because it feels like guys have gotten better at closing. Do you think that is a mental effect kind of that you're speaking to now, or am I imagining that conundrum to begin with?
No, that's actually probably true. There's so much that goes into playing the tour now, and the whole mental part of it, they've all heard how to apply all these skill sets and practice these certain techniques to get their mind straight. Every one of them that plays at this level's gotten to that point. But then you they've got so much to deal with, the analytics, the social media. The social media is pressure, I think, because if you hit a crummy shot, you're going to get two thumbs firing at you in the blink of an eye, calling you a choker. Guys like Poulter that are really out there, how many times has he been called a choker on Twitter? Probably a million. I couldn't handle it personally. But these guys can handle it. They know how to deal. The pressure on Sunday, it depends who it is. You know, when Tiger walks up there on Sunday, he's not feeling the same as Brendan Steele might have been feeling a couple weeks ago. It's just not the same. Even Xander Schauffele's not feeling like Tiger is when Tiger shows up. But it's something you get used to. We all get used to it. We get used to all of it. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes something that you just deal with without much issue.
You mentioned the President's Cup a bit earlier. Just wondering what that is like to broadcast and to go all the way to Australia to see Royal Melbourne, a golf course that's very different from anything else you see any other week. How much fun is that event to broadcast?
It was great. Royal Melbourne would have been my all-time favorite golf course, except for that it's two courses put together to be one. So that is the only thing. There's very few places I've ever been where every single hole, I just walked up on the hole and just said, well, wow, look at this. Look at this hole. The great part about that whole trip, we were in the Bahamas, and we were able to get on the charter, about four of us, with NBC. Hicks was on there. Producers were on there, and everybody else was coming from different places. And we were on with the team. We stopped in Acapulco for 3 hours from the Bahamas to refuel. It took forever. And there was a killer plane. And I was able to go up. We all did. Hang with the players up there in the big round tables like when we're sitting at here. A bar and the people serving drink. It was just unreal. We're on that plane for 26 hours, but it was just so fun. To get to know them and to see what the deal was. When it was wheels up in Acapulco, there was no more alcohol for that team until they left or until they won. Those guys were pretty relaxed, but also at the same time, they were pretty disciplined. And I had a great time up there. Tiger had a couple of drinks, and he was having a big time, and Kuchar was hilarious. He loves this particular brand of tequila. He was killer. Tiger was cutting cards for like $100 a cut, high low. I came walking in there. I haven't said, Tiger and I don't talk. I was one of the guys at ESPN that had to do Sports Center hits on him when he was going through everything. It was hard because I love Tiger. I was Ryder Cup partners and all that. But, he looks at me, but we don't really talk that much anymore. I'm TV now, so it's all right. But we still talk. But anyway, I walked into that area, part the curtains, go up there into where all the players are hanging. And he's Tiger, looks up, he goes, Zingy, come over here, cut me 100 high lows. I was like, I'm not doing that. But he was ready to go. And, he just was one of the guys. His hat was on backwards. He was wearing a T-shirt. Those players love him. It was great to see Tiger look like that and be that guy to a whole generation of kids that don't even remember one thing about me. I remember the day Tiger showed up. They don't know squat about me. I've gone that old to where I remember Tiger when he showed up. Untouchable. Couldn't get in that inner circle. Couldn't get near him for a practice round. If I wanted to play a practice round, it would have been impossible to play a practice rounds with Tiger. He was locked up. O'Meara, Cook, maybe. It's a different guy, man. He just let his guard down. He went from uncomfortable if you're comfortable with him to more uncomfortable if you're not comfortable with him, Tiger. And I like this Tiger more. I don't know if he'll ever be. He won't be as good as the other Tiger, but that's the body. Mm-hmm. But after seeing that and then seeing the comeback, I feel like after Stricker's President's Cup or Ryder Cup, after Stricker's Ryder Cup in Wisconsin, I think that the Tour and the PGA of America should name Tiger all-time captain. If the PGA of America really wants to win, and maybe they'll win with Strick, they need to get rid of that attitude that there's more captains than there are Ryder Cups. That I would have loved to have done several Ryder Cups. Instead of 18 or 19 living captains, I think it would have been great, if there was 11 living captains. Maybe I would have never been a captain because the captains before me would have captained for a few years. But the attitude at the PGA of America has always been more, we just want to give you the honor of being the captain and also the punishment of what that did for how you're going to be remembered because you got your butt handed to you.
Well, how important is it, and I realize I'm asking a former player in this regard, but how important is it, how necessary is it for a player to be the captain of the Ryder Cup team?
Oh, you're thinking like bring in...
That's an open-ended question. I'm just saying, why does
bring
it
in
have,
baseball,
have to be
football.
A player?
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't. It doesn't, but it should. Anybody could do it, I suppose. Ken Venturi captained the President's Cup team, and he didn't know what clubs players were using, all that stuff. He knew how golf worked, and he knows how personalities work, I think. He knew that. Yeah, I think you'll never go outside of the players being the captains. I think the one rule that needed to go away altogether was the idea that you had to have won a major to be a Ryder Cup captain is stupid. And
It's amazing when you hear people talk about the reasons why people get selected
and that, oh, he's got all this, he's got so much experience. Like, oh yeah, he's a PGA champion.
And he was a gutty player. He was a gutty Ryder Cup. He's a good match play player.
I'm just like, I don't think that's the reason. Like, some of the teams that have won, I don't think it's because the player won a major 20 years prior to that. I mean, so that's where, and I know you've got, we've talked 08 with you, I know, and I know we've talked about the philosophy behind that team you built, but how did you win the captaincy? How did you become the captain, and how did you present that strategy?
I, at the right age at the right time, I was really a pretty lucky Ryder Cup player. I got great pairings. I could have had obscure Ryder Cups, but because, you know, you hand in the envelope, the Europe hands in an envelope, we hand in an envelope, open them up, and you see what sequence of order they'll go. You're not looking for matches, but I always played all their best players. I suppose I could say I was really unlucky. I drew all their best players, but it made more marquee opportunity for me, and I played really well against Seve and Jose, and I, you know, Chip Beck and I beat Faldo and Woosnam. But to draw Faldo and Woosnam, they'd never been beaten. It's hard luck, but it was great, a great opportunity. So I had that reputation as a Ryder Cup player. Then I won the PGA Championship. I got sick after that, but I had endeared myself to them a little bit. So I got offered the opportunity to captain in 06 after Payne had passed. And I really didn't want to do that. I just didn't. And I also wanted to be the captain in America.
I was going to say, just wanted a home one.
I did want to be. Yeah, that was, you know, Dave Stockton called me and said, don't do it. So it was promised to me, 08. I'm 48 years old. They got slaughtered in 06 and 04, lost by 9 points. Never happened before. 2 times in a row, just wiped out. And who was the captain? 06. Lehman was the captain. He had other guys. Corey was in there, but Corey apparently was going to be, all of a sudden, he must have been in there lobbying or something, because I got a call from a past president of the PGA of America. Said, Zinger, you still want to be the captain for 08? I said, yeah, I thought that was the case. He goes, no, you're getting ready to lose it. So I had to call the PGA of America, and I talked to the president of the PGA of America at the time, Roger Warren, and I lobbied. And I lobbied my idea, which was to take a large group of 12 and break them into three small groups of four. And then the idea was to put them together. Well, I didn't actually have this at the time, but to put them together by like personalities. But I just told them that I wanted to take that Navy SEALs concept of team building. Turns out Roger Warren was an ex-basketball coach, and he loved it, and he embraced it. And I ended up getting it, but I had to lobby for it. It was promised to me, and I had to lobby for it. That's kind of the disconnect between the tour and the PGA of America, too. It's a real example of how much turnover and change there can be. But I really believe if the PGA of America wants to win these Ryder Cups now, where winning is what matters, you know, European Tour owns their Ryder Cup. The PGA of America owns our, not the PGA Tour. And I would just make Tiger all-time captain.
I like that idea. A couple big things that have gone on in the world of golf. One that puts you, I believe, as a broadcaster that with NBC that has a partnership with the PGA Tour, has put you in a difficult situation, is the incident that happened with Patrick Reed in the Bahamas right before the President's Cup, and the backlash that has come from that. Let's start simple with this. Do you think his punishment, 2-shot penalty, and continue on, do you think that was a just punishment for the violation?
It doesn't seem like it, because it seems so blatant. You know, the best compliment I got over that whole situation was from a guy named Steve Eubanks, who writes for golf, what's it called? Global Golf Post. And he said, you struck the right tone, which was really all we could do. That was a tough situation, but I was so happy to be on the call live. Hicks and I went and talked to Patrick Reed Sunday morning, because we kept hearing what everybody else was saying, but we felt like we wanted to hear it from him. So we approached him, and pretty much the question Hicks asked him, I think, was, we've heard from everybody else. What do you want us to say? Brilliant. So we asked him, you know, did you know the rule? He said, I knew the rule. I didn't feel like I really improved my lie. He went right back to the camera angle thing. And then I just asked him, or maybe Dan did you see the sand move or feel it move? And he said, no. I mean, I don't know. I just looked at Dan. I said, I don't know. I said, you know, we'll report what he said. To have an opinion about it is different than reporting what he said. I felt like that was our responsibility. But my take on it was that the highest handicapped player at your home course knows better than that. And it was a tough situation. Plus, he's on the plane on that charter going over there to the President's Cup, too. So, interesting dynamic. I don't know what was going through his head when that happened. He said he knew the rule. There's a part of me in that situation I wish I would have done something a little different. Because the ball's sitting there, you got that lump of sand behind it, and he swished it away with his club twice and threw it out there. He said he never saw it move, never felt it. But what's the difference if he goes down there and picks it up one grain at a time? How far down could he get to the bottom before it becomes a breach? And we remember the official standing over Stewart Cink at Hilton Head when he was down there and he was flicking the thing out of there one at a time. So I almost wanted, I think we almost let the ruling body off the hook by saying, well, what's the difference if he'd have gone down there with his finger and spent 5 minutes, 3 minutes in there doing that?
Is sand a loose impediment?
Right. To what point is it a breach of the rule? Is it a breach of the rule when you shovel it out? The penalty's two strokes, whether it was a blatant intent to cheat, I don't think so. I just don't know what he was thinking. If you can crawl on that head and figure it out, let me know.
Yeah, it almost happened to me in a tournament a couple weeks ago where my ball came to rest against divot sand. Like, the divot sand was on the right of it. And my instinct, honestly, if the reed situation never would have happened, I'd have brushed that sand away. I wouldn't even thought, because I just didn't know that rule was interpreted that way. But once the backlash started and I started reading about it, I was like, whoa, if a tour player should know that rule and should know the touch, should be able to feel that sand move. It's a tough situation.
Hey, a tour player knows better than to improve his situation.
Yeah.
And that really didn't do enough to improve the situation to where he could hit a good shot. So it's one of the greatest mysteries. You know, there was a college coach one time that was telling his players, I won't say who he was, but, you know, if there was a stick under your ball or a pine needle, to look away and snatch it, then you can say you never saw the ball move. And I'm like, oh, wow. Well, I mean, maybe he was making his practice swings like that. I don't know. But I really like Patrick Reed. I don't know what's going on. Sometimes you think that maybe he needs an intervention or something. Yeah. But I just really like him. I love watching him play golf. But I don't think he's Captain America or anything.
No, I don't think he is. Not anymore, I don't think. Was it awkward on the plane with him?
Not
with
at all.
No?
He was great, just like nothing happened. Yeah. And when he walked in, he and his wife were a little bit late and to the first big holding area where everybody was. All the caddies were on the flight, all perfectly normal. And I just don't know that anybody knew quite how to get into his head to know what he was thinking. The camera's sitting there behind him. The guy's holding it. I don't know. Yeah. It's a great mystery.
Well, back to what you were talking about with Tiger on the plane and how different that guy is now. Like, what, compare and contrast him, you know, playing $100 high lows on the plane versus what you experienced when you were a Ryder Cup teammate with him. Does he kind of seclude himself in those scenarios?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He was more secluded. We
what
were partners.
What years did you play with him at the Ryder Cup?
I know I was with him in 2002. Seems like we're on a President's Cup team. He stayed back and kind of observed, you know, almost the way I was about NBC. I had to just kind of get my words in, do my job, and see how it all worked and all functions. And that's kind of what he was doing. And I'm sure through the years he's assessed, you know, kind of what's been great, what hasn't been great, but he didn't come out there like a team leader. Mm-hmm. And when he came into the team room and those guys were getting waxed after day one, he came in with his hat on backwards, a big smile on his face. Those guys were all nervous, but he wasn't nervous. He just like, hey, I think he said something like, hey, we still got jet lag. We don't even know the course yet. It's all right. Let's hang in there. He really did trust his players. My theme there as the week went on became more, you know, Tiger trusts them. And Ernie says, trust me, as a captain, he knew the course like the back of his hand. He's got the course record there. He's won tournaments at Royal Melbourne. And Ernie said, if you hit driver in this hole, you're not playing tomorrow. You know, play it the way I tell you to play it. There's a couple guys that went against him on the first tee shot of the golf tournament, actually, on Sunday. But all in all, you know, the Tiger dynamic isn't going to be an inspirational message as much as it's going to be more of a confident kind of I don't know. He just, I think one of my best qualities at our Ryder Cup was everybody on our team had confidence and my confidence in them. And if I gave them confidence, imagine what it is when Tiger shows his confidence in them. And I think that's what happened at this President's Cup. The more I think about it, he showed that he had confidence in them, and that made all the difference in the world. I really do think that he should be locked in for a while if he wants to do it.
I like that idea. What you mentioned too, kind of, I guess, was there a falling out between you and Tiger at any point? I know you said you were never. You were media when things kind of hit the fan for him there in 2009. And the way I understand the way Tiger operates is just like people just become, nope, like you're out. I don't talk to you anymore. Did you feel like that was the case? Or
I didn't know. I never had a conversation with him about it. Yeah. It was just sort of obvious to me that it was just a little different, you know, more side-eye-ish and stuff, which is cool. I get it. I was fair to Tiger, honestly, and always, you know, when I was tweeting, I was always the naysayers beware guy on Tiger Woods.
I remember that.
That was it. You keep calling, you know, don't count him out. Now, see, that's another thing I'm right about. He's as good as anybody in the world right now.
Yeah.
And they're going to get what they wished for, which is they're going to get hammered by him. They better sack up if they want to beat that guy, because he's not going to beat himself down the stretch very rarely, and he's still a clutch putter. You know, I wish I was playing better when Tiger first showed up in 97. I was just past my prime, got back from all the treatments of being sick and all that crap, and I missed him. I just missed him. I wish I was like the ferocious bulldog that could have tried to see if I had the heart to take him down. I had one chance last group on Sunday at Jack's tournament, and he shot the easiest 65 I'd ever seen in my life. We were going down 17, and I remember I hadn't said Jack to him all day except nice shot. And we walked up 17. We already hit our second shots, and I trotted up to him. And all I could think to say was, hey, I feel like I owe you an apology today. He said, what for? I said, I don't know, bro. I said, just some reason I felt like maybe you thought I could give you more today, and I just couldn't do it. And he busted out laughing. And that's how I felt. He was, at that point in his career, he was like, well, maybe Azinger can beat me. Maybe Azinger can give me a little trouble. I didn't have anything for him. He shot the easiest 65 you've ever seen.
I remember the shot he hit in a number five.
I'll never forget it. My neck still hurts from looking at that ball. He hit a 2 or 3 iron. I think it was a 2 iron to this front pin. I had hit a 3 wood earlier, like a dummy, right before him. I should have laid up because I'd hit a dozen 9 pitching wedge or sand wedges within 3 feet of the hole that week. And for some reason, I hit 3 wood and I thinned it, and it was right at it. Hit the bank, rolled in the water. I made bogey. But once it went in the water, he got up there and hit. And I looked at my caddy. I was like, I'm so glad he's going for this. He's going to follow me right in there. You watch. Whack! He hit that ball at my neck. I was like, oh! I'm looking up like this. My neck! I never seen a ball leave that high in my life, and he never moved a blade of grass. Whack! Right in there about 5 feet. Tapped it in for eagle. 3-shot swing. I was 2 up.
Oh.
1 down. And from that point on, there was no – he never missed a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't give him any trouble. And it was killing me I couldn't give him any trouble, because I just wanted to give him some trouble there at the end, and I couldn't.
Just to see how he would have handled it.
Well,
you know how he would have handled it.
I know how he would have handled it.
At least you could find out. All right, so I got some of your predictions down that you gave golf.com, and one of them is that Tiger's going to win a major this year. You've had some good predictions as of late. Which one's it going to be? Are you willing to say?
Oh, Tiger?
Yeah.
Rory's going to win the Masters.
Okay, I saw that one on there too.
Well, you know what the guy asked me? He asked me for 5 outrageous predictions.
Okay.
Give me outrageous predictions. You know, like, yeah, I could have done anything. Cameron Smith would win a tournament. That's on there. Is it on there?
Cameron Smith will be the best Aussie player in the world, is what you said.
Oh, crap. Well, he is right now. Well, Leishman might give him a little trouble. I meant to say he'd win a tournament. So I think he wrote it wrong. I really feel like Tiger's going to win the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, because he's so much more in control right now off the tee, and he's the best putter by a wide margin. And, you know, Wingfoot's a beast. It's a beast. He's been there enough. He missed the cut there last time. But I just think he's going to win a U.S. Open. That's what I think.
You gave another one there that Patrick Cantlay will ascend to number one player in the world. I think he's a guy that people don't talk about quite enough. What makes you think – what do you see in him that is number one player in the world?
Just watching him flight it and his demeanor, the way he gets it up and in. I like everything about him, and he's got that personality type. But you remember, these are outrageous predictions I was making, and I was like,
"No, well, I don't have a problem with that at all. I think he would be if I pick."
But Spieth, nobody's going to think.
I know.
No one's going to call that.
No, I always pick Spieth to win the Masters. But if I was going to change that pick, I would pick Cantlay.
Yeah, me too.
I think he's going to win a green jacket.
Rory's winning the Masters.
I know. Rory, you know
what happened?
Why is he going to win?
Because when he went to the Open Championship and he tried to pretend like it was any other tournament and all that, he learned a valuable lesson. They're not all the same, buddy. Not all these tournaments are the same. Some of them are bigger than others. This is the biggest event, the greatest chance of your life to play in Northern Ireland on this golf course. He tried to blow it off like it was any other event, and it just was fake, and it irritated me. It just irritated me to not just say, I'm going to be the most nervous I've ever been. I can't wait to hit that first drive. I hope I can keep it between the stakes. That is real. Not it's going to be like any other tournament. He learned his lesson, and then he just gutted out the rest of the year and played great. Got all the money, $15 million, you know. Now you can tweet back to Elkington how much more money he has than the last time.
You remember that one, huh?
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. I've never been a huge Rory fan or believer. I loved him when he was Pudgy Rory. And, you know, Pudgy Rory never got injured either. I've said that before, but Fit Rory's hurt all the time. And I was really glad to hear Fit Rory say, I'm not going to go crazy anymore. You know, if you could work on that little tendon in the knee that blows out, that keeps these guys from playing, or that whatever, I'd work out on these elbows, and I'd work out on that little bitty patella, whatever it is. But they all want to look pretty, and they want to build up and all that. And I get it. They want to be strong. But they get injured, and I'm just glad Rory, hopefully he can play injury-free. But it was always, you know, as he got better and the pressure amped up, he got more in that kind of denial mode about it. But he faced the music after the Open, and I believe it helped him to have a bad week there. I think he's going to win the Masters.
Let's hope so. I'd vote for that. All right, so this, we talked to Peter Jacobson about this last week, about the Premier Golf League, this new proposed World Tour. I like getting the insight from guys that were at least a part of the conversation when this was drummed up in the 1990s. What do you remember about that time from the 90s, and where do you stand on the possibilities and the likelihood of this tour?
The thinking immediately is, if you're in it, you're in for the rest of your life. How do you fall out of that World Golf League? How do you get into that World Golf League? It's just another tour, and it's a joke. It's not going to happen. The PGA Tour and the commissioner, he's going to say, Jay Monahan's going to say, well, choose. It's over before it starts. It makes for good fodder, though.
I mean, so you think there's no way that guys would ever leave for just
some guys might.
Yeah.
But I think it has a 0% chance.
Okay.
See how that prediction plays out.
Okay. I'm with you. I think it's too big of a hurdle to clear to ask guys to give up all their
stuff. The tour's going to say that, and then you have TV contracts in place and all that stuff that you got to sign on when you first qualify for the tour. You sign that stuff. So, yeah, I think it's all a lot to do about nothing.
What do you remember about the 90s? When
same problem.
Same, yeah.
The commissioner at the time could have been Beaming. It's probably Fincham.
Fincham.
He gave us a choice. And you're going to choose the tour once that choice is obvious.
Yeah.
Down to the nitty gritty on that.
I think it's just, you know, players are not picketing. They're not, you know, they're not saying we need this. Here's our demands. There's not really, not serious complaints or serious issues enough to like really actually leave.
Yeah. It's almost like we've just wasted too much time on this topic already because it is really that much of a non-topic. It sounds awesome though.
Yeah.
And if I'm wrong, then I'll be wolfing down a crow.
I'm with you. And we didn't spend time on it until recent when the stories came out and the money being, you know, very real.
Look how much money is on the tour. This new contract coming into the PGA Tour. I mean, the purse at TPC is going to be like $15 million or something.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think it's going to happen, but I need to get your insight.
All right, there it is.
What about the distance report? Well, yeah, I know you haven't read it yet. We're recording this on the day the USGA distance report comes out, but we talked about it a little bit at lunch. To sum it up, the USGA appears to be on the path to finally addressing the fact that the ball goes very far. Do you think that's a good idea? Are you surprised it took this long? What do you think?
Well, everybody knows the ball goes really, really far. I don't know. I think the USGA said their data didn't show that necessarily. And, you know, I mean, I talked to those guys. I said, just quit saying that and go get the data and quit saying that, because everybody knows it's going farther. But I think it's a great thing. I love the fact that the balls can hang in the air for 10 or 12 seconds. And I just think it's cool. Now, if you're airmailing bunkers and making stuff obsolete, I get that. Add a bunker. It's not that big a deal. If you're going to play regular events on tour, add a bunker. You know, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, yeah, back in our day, par was 72. Well, the ball's going so far now in the 2020s, it's pars are about 71, sometimes 70 now. You don't have to change the ball. Let the ball do what it does. Stop it. I love it. I just love it that guys can hit it like that. Watch, standing on the range and watching it, if you've never been to a driving range on a PGA Tour, it will blow your mind.
Do you think it pick up your game and put you in 2019 in your prime? Do you think that you would have get an advantage by the new technology against your peers, or do you think it would have hurt you against your peers?
I don't think it would have mattered one bit or the other, you know, one way or the other. Yeah. Bobby Jones would have been good. And, you know, if we all use hickory sticks, Rory McIlroy would still be beating everybody to the ground, and so would Tiger. If we use lady shafts or aluminum shafts, the best players would still be the best. So I just feel like I'm going to go with the idea that nothing's any different. That when it comes to being a player, you got to just get it in the hole, man. Mm-hmm. You got to chip and putt.
Going back to 2008 Ryder Cup, I got a bunch of questions I want to ask you about this, but one of which, you captained the guy on that team that, you know, is almost a mythological figure in the game. You know who I'm talking
Anthony
about?
Anthony Kim,
all
man.
Right. What was it like captaining him? What stories do you have of him from that week?
He was the team leader at age 21. He might have just turned 22. And he had the AK bling going with the big belt buckle and all that. And he was just really cool to be around, had that youthful enthusiasm, and he was so cocky. But he's a street kid. Somebody told me he's all tatted up, you know, grew up in L.A. playing pickup hoops with guys and just a stud athlete. His whole thing when he came in, first of all, with this whole pod system concept, it was going to be Mickelson and Anthony Kim with Justin Leonard, and it turned out they picked Hunter Mahan. All green light personality types, but AK and Mickelson wanted to be together, which I wasn't sure it was going to be all that great, but it was once that anybody could have gone with anybody in that pot of four. And of course, Mickelson wanted him because he knew how many birdies he made. Yeah, so I was sloughing. Oh, really, Phil? You can go out on a limb and take AK? All Anthony Kim wanted to do that week was play Sergio. Hey, Zinger, can you find Sergio for me? I want to kick his ass. I said, bro, it doesn't work that way. I got to do an envelope. They got to do an envelope. We turn it in. On Sunday, he draws him in the first match out. And he walked up to me on the first tee. And my whole message for those players was, you know, you're going to show, let's go show off this week. Let's show off. I walked up to AK on the first tee, he's coming up the hill there. I said, well, buddy, you going to show off for me today? He says, I'm going to whoop his ass for you today, Captain. And he did. He whooped his ass. And when he got done, he didn't even know he'd beaten him. Turned around, starts running off, and I come walking. They say, oh, no, you won the match. He comes back to me, and he hit me three times on the chest. I told you I was going to whoop that ass. I told you I was going to whoop. He just went street kid and then grabbed that flag and took off, and it was like, never saw him again. I saw him one other time doing an outing somewhere, and he was hurt. He had something on his wrist, and I'd never seen him since. And I don't talk to him. He disappeared on me. And you're right, he's a mythological figure, kind of iconish almost.
Well, it's just it's amazing just how far off the face of the earth he's fallen from the golf world. Without it, and I know the injuries that he had were pretty debilitating from a golf standpoint, but it's just – it's amazing. I feel like nobody talks to him. Nobody has any insight. And it's just this huge, everybody, there's not a month goes by where somebody doesn't ask us like, hey, did you track down Anthony Kim yet? Where's he at?
The only other player I've ever seen do that was Jody Mudd. And guys my age, I'm 60 now, people my age will remember Jody Mudd. He won the Players and the Tour Championship in the same year. And a couple years later, he just retired and was gone. Never to be heard from again. He shows up now at the Players Past Champions Dinner. It's really weird to see Jody Mudd like that, but what a player he was. And AK disappeared. He got hurt. There's, you know, rumors are he's collecting on this massive disability insurance, but there's so much money to be had out here on the tour. I mean, you got guys that have, what could it possibly be? Disability, 20 million. Well, even if it's 20 million, I mean, you got guys that have won two times on the PGA Tour that have 45 million career earnings, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Plus sponsors, because you lose all the sponsors. Yeah. It has to be more than that.
Yeah, there's just I will be forever curious on that topic, I think. But one thing I wanted to ask about 08, I've never seen this at any other Ryder Cup since then. The rally you guys had before the event, how did that come about? Was that your idea?
They were having the pep rally, and we just decided to show up. I mean, wanted to be there the whole time. You know, we made lapel pins up, had 10,000 lapel pins we were pitching to the crowd. You know, we invited everybody to the pep rally. We had always intended to go to the pep rally. And then something happened the night of the pep rally. It just ran so late. It's like, what? I said, we're out. We're teeing off the next morning. We're not going. And all the players came up and said, bullshit, we're going. And that's how that worked out. And so all the players wanted to go to the pep rally. That made me feel good. And it was cool. We were sneaking through these stores that were connected on the street there in downtown Louisville and went through a library. And popped out on that stage. The cheerleaders were there from Louisville and University of Kentucky. Patino spoke. When we busted on that stage, they were going crazy, you know, throwing T-shirts in the crowd. And I remember getting blasted for telling the crowd that they were our 13th man, which was really almost, you know, I own the phrase 13th man now with Alex Maselli and Dave Shedlosky, Europe and the United States. We're going to try to do something with 13th man. Hopefully it'll happen. But I remember telling the crowd that you could cheer when they miss. You can cheer when they miss. European fans understand that. Our fans don't. And I got asked about that a little bit
after
it was over. European media. Paul, did you really suggest that they cheer when we miss? I was like, yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. Because you do it to us.
They do it. They love to act like they don't, and it's totally fine. Like I don't think anybody has a problem with
it. It wasn't malicious. It was just about educating, and Westwood got really ticked off about that. We had some good times at that Ryder Cup. J.B. Holmes was an interesting cat at that Ryder Cup, too.
How so?
Well, we picked him. He knew Valhalla like the back of his hand. He got there really too early, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The player showed up on Monday. Sunday night, I'd gotten there early. Saturday, I guess, I got there. And I was eating with JB on Sunday in our room. And he gave me the, I hope somebody pisses me off this week, Singer. He didn't say much. I didn't know what to say to him, really. How come, JB? Oh, if someone pisses me off, I'll kick their ass. I was like, oh, man, you're like me, JB. So I filed that back into my head there. And then on day one, JB and Boo went out in the afternoon the first day, and they were getting waxed. And Olin Brown was following that redneck pod around. We lovingly called them the redneck group. Kenny Perry and Jim Furyk were in there as well. And he said that JB was blowing it way to the right, and they were two down, and blah, blah, blah. So I went up to JB. Oh, I was in the clubhouse. Dan Hicks was showing Lee Westwood, who was ticked off at me already. And he was pissed at Boo because Boo was doing, you know, raising his arms up to get the crowd to go crazy. And I had seen that, and Hicks had made comment that Westwood was shooting him dirty looks. So we got down there. JB's on 9 in the right-hand rough. And I caught him walking up the hill there, and I said, slow down a minute. I said, Olin Brown says you're missing these shots to the right. I just called your coach, Matt Killen. He says when you're missing it to the right, you're coming down too much from the inside. I said, has he ever told you that before? He goes, yeah, he's told me that before. I said, does that make sense to you right now? He goes, yeah, it makes sense. I said, good, we'll go get him. And I took about 3 steps, and I turned around. I said, oh, hey, one more thing. I said, I don't know if you realize this or not, but Westwood's shooting you dirty looks. And Boo Daddy's like, or no, JB's like, oh, that's, you know, it pissed him off. And anyway.
That was it. He got what he asked for. He wanted somebody to piss him off.
He did. And he hit it a foot on the next hole. He had driver 7-iron over the green on 600-yard par 5. They came back and tied the match. They should have won the match, but it just such an opportunity to message these guys in those matches. I just love it.
What was the atmosphere at home Ryder Cups is usually well documented, but kind of just glossed over. I mean, everyone just loves to say how rowdy the crowd was, but it felt like Louisville was different than other U.S. Ryder Cups as far as the presence. Can you talk about the presence on the ground?
Yeah, I really felt like that the golf course was set and built for it. They removed 2,000 or 3,000 trees to make room for spectators, and Jack did a great job of creating kind of a stadium look to that golf course. There was miles of corporate tents. And, you know, again, the message really, even to the crowd, was to match our outfits on Sunday. And, you know, I think the players made eye contact with those folks, and they really loved it, and they embraced it. And, you know, gas, they were right in the middle of election. Gas prices were sniffing $4.50 a gallon. I mean, there was a lot going on emotionally. It's a great escape, that sporting event, for a lot of Patriots.
I didn't think about that. I guess that was like 2 weeks after Lehman Brothers collapse. Yeah, that was,
that was been, right. Maybe it was the a next stressful week. Yeah. Time.
That's interesting. All right, last two. What are some mistakes you see captains of team events make? What are common captaincy mistakes in your mind?
Two huge mistakes, I think. Trying to motivate them, number one, is the biggest mistake. And then Saturday nights, that somehow this tradition got started where we all sit around the table and everybody goes around individually and talks about the week and what it's meant to them. And, you know, if you're behind, I can understand that. You know, I remember Ken Green back in the 89, maybe, way back then. Such a controversial guy back then. And Lanny and Raymond and Watson and all these great players, Kite, Floyd. I said Raymond. Anyway, he just stood up and he said, you know, when I got here, I didn't like any of you guys. Matter of fact, I hated most of you. But now my feelings have changed. I really like y'all. And he just sat down. It was like, you almost wanted to cry. You know, you almost wanted to cry. We've had great moments. I remember one time Chip Beck stood up in that team room. And we've had great moments. But I think if you're ahead, you can't do this kumbaya on Saturday night. Davis and them did it. In 2012, they lost their edge. Europe's calling the ghost of Seve over there, and they end up coming back and winning. But anyway, Chip Beck stood up one time. He and John Cook were not playing that great, and they went last match out, and I think they drew Monty and Woozy. Impossible to beat them, and they got them. They beat them. And Chip Beck, we were just all so excited for Chipper and Cook to win that match, and Chip Beck stood up, and I remember it. I'll never forget this. He said, boys, I want you to know that the will to win can overcome a mechanical breakdown like I was having out there today. And we just busted out laughing because he was struggling, bro. But they got it done. The will to win can overcome a mechanical breakdown like I was having out there today. Wow.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Brilliant. Well, our Saturday night we were leading, and I had a couple of the wives say, hey, we haven't done our thing yet. You know, we give the gifts and all that. I said, yeah, you know what? We're not going to do that this year. And we did it Sunday night after we won. I told Davis, don't do that if you're ahead, Davis, but they did it. Well, I don't know what happened Saturday night in 2016 when they won, but I lobbied hard for Davis to get another chance. Dad, member of the PGA of America, Davis winning a PGA championship. They wanted to go a different direction than Davis and after 2012. After 2014, the Watson pick, that's when the controversy hit the fan. And I really argued and lobbied hard for Davis to get another chance.
What was the celebration like after the 91 Ryder Cup?
The 91 Ryder Cup. I don't know. Why do you ask about that?
I don't know. We talked a lot of 91 last time, but I don't think I ever got to that question.
You know, the Kia was so weird. You know, there wasn't even a clubhouse for us. There was trailers, two temporary trailers. It's a mile walk from 9 Green to 10 T. They had to take a bus or a car or shuttle something to get us there. I think we all left. I think it was the worst celebration ever. Honestly, I think
I remember the pictures where everybody's on the beach.
That was right after the matches. Those guys went down to the beach. Cal could like wreck the last four or five holes and lost his match, so he was going bananas, psycho somewhere. And those, I loved Bernard Langer at the time, so when he missed, I was more gutted for him and how he would have to deal. He won the next two tournaments, by the way, no big deal.
Of course he did.
So I didn't go down to the beach to celebrate because I didn't want to rub his nose in it. If you'll notice the 18-hole celebration, you won't see me because I backed out because I love Bernard so much, I backed out of there. I didn't want to be a part of it. Everybody thought I was such a prick at Ryder Cups, but, you know, I just was patriotic and did what I had to do. But I had a heart, you know, I had a heart for Bernard and what he was going to feel. I think the greatest celebration was 08, our Ryder Cup. Europeans come up, they're all wasted. Podrick was hammered, had this paisley white Irish skin and his shirt unbuttoned and gold chains and all that leaning together. He was hilarious. It's just great to see those guys like that. Anthony Kim setting up shots on the pool table and we're all toasting to the competition and doing the stuff you do. Boo Weekly's, you know, telling all both teams, he's sharing a story about getting in the ring with the orangutan, and it was just awesome. Westwood was drunk and he was over there signing our posters, and Boo'd come over, hey, these are our, don't be signing our stuff. And, you know, Westwood disappear for a minute, and then he slithered back over there. We had a wall of stuff, two walls really, of stuff to sign, hats, posters, flags, you name it. And it takes all week to get through them. Westwood is over there sabotaging, you know, signing our stuff. Boo Daddy, finally Boo gave the whistle, stood on a chair, everybody quiet. And it was scary for a sec. He stood up there and he said, hey, if anybody wants to sign anything in this room, he pulled up his big old bell and he stuck it out. Come sign this right here. And it just was perfect, man. We had the, it was just a great, great celebration.
I can tell how excited you always get to talk about it. That's
yeah,
fine.
Thanks
I
for
should
ask.
Have started with that.
No, thanks for asking.
Fired up.
Yeah.
It's really a treat. So, all right. Well, Paul, thanks again for coming on the podcast and all the tremendous stories and all the insight, and best of luck with the rest of the year.
Keep up the good work, guys.
All right. Cheers.
Be the right club today.
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!